Welcome back, Hemming. Oh, sugar. Sorry about that. Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the podcast. Sorry for punching the microphone. We did a skip day yesterday. So thanks for your patience there. And before that, we read, what was it, chapter 15? Chapter 15. Is that right? Oh, I'm looking at the wrong thing. Sorry. We read, chapter 9.2. And I believe we finished the chapter, if I'm not mistaken. Let me double check that. Sorry, these are things I should have done before I started. Yes, we did. We finished chapter 9. Okay. From what I've read, says Swim, George had pretty much alienated everyone he knew by the end of his life. I can certainly understand why. Another thing, except for Lady Gregory and a few mentions of mistresses, mothers, peasants, etc., women are completely missing as main characters. Hey, now that you mention it, you're right. Father Tom's novel, Father Tom Found Time to Publish, under the pseudonym Thomas Whitlock, a best-selling novel, The Chances of War, based on the life of Owen Roe O'Neill, which went through several editions. Owen Roe O'Neill was a Gaelic-Irish soldier from the 1500s. Left Ireland at a young age, spent most of his life as a mercenary in the Spanish army. Okay, so Father Tom did do his novel, and it was successful, so that's kind of cool. Techrific quoted, "It is about me and in me. Solipsistic more is more than I can bear. I mean, most authors are self-centered, but by necessity, and the work itself kind of demands it in order for it to be successful. But there are limits. His religiousness is paper thin, and his egotism is quite frankly unbearable." Oh, this is a challenging book, isn't it? I feel like it would be perfectly reasonable for us to say we have read this book to the reasonable degree that anyone would read this book. You know, how many hours into this book? I'm going to guess, 20 hours of reading, maybe not quite that much, but let's just say that for argument's sake. And how much of that 20 hours has hinted that there is going to be any feeling of satisfaction or any reward for us to continue reading? You know, I think it's 100% safe for us to say at this point, and fair to say, hey, we've read this book up to the point we were certain that there was no value in continuing to read it. And I almost feel like, what if a pitch, what if we summarize the rest of the book? There's probably, 20 chapters left. What if we just did a chapter summary for each of those 20 and not actually read them? And in the knowledge that there is going to be no value in reading it. It's just going to be a waste of our time. None of us are enjoying the book. So that's one thing I've been thinking about for the last few days. Like, do we just call it what it is, a bad book? We got to the end of it by summarizing each chapter. We know exactly what happened in every single chapter. There's no point extrapolating those actions out over, 100,000 words or whatever we've got left, because there's no value in the words of this book. So that's an idea I had, but I also know for a fact that I won't be satisfied with that long term. I'm going to look back and go, wow, I read the whole Hemingway list, 99% of it, and then I gave up at the 99% mark of, so close to the finishing line. So as tempting as that solution sounds, I don't know. I'm going to humor it as an option and put it out there. I don't think I would be satisfied with that option, but I just want to feel out what you guys reckon. But it's like, are we being too sentimental? Are we being too semantic about it? Do we just say, yeah, look, we read the whole list. One of the books sucked. So after, reading, 500 pages of it and having another 500 pages to go, we realized we didn't want to read the next half and we gave up on it. Does that count? begs the question. Who knows? Okay. Chapter 10. Let's go. One day, while walking home with John Eglinton from Professor Dowden's, I mentioned that I was thinking of writing a volume of short stories about Irish life, like Turgenev's Tales of a Sportsman and the face that would be ugly if unlighted by the intelligence lit up. And you will require how many stories to make the volume? 9, 10, or 12, a year's work. Do you think you'll be able to find subjects all the while? The question kindled my vanity, and I answered, Turgenev wrote the Tales of a Sportsman in Paris and sent them to a Russian newspaper week by week. Maupassant contributed 2 stories a week to the Gil Bias, but it does not follow that because Maupassant and Turgenev were always able to find new subjects, I shall. And Father Tom restricting the zone of my stories. The stories I am thinking of are longer than Maupassant's. As soon as I had bidden him goodbye, my thoughts went away in search of subjects, and before my steps were taken, I remembered Dick Lennox, the fat man in A Mummer's Wife. He used to lodge in a factory town in Lancashire, in a house of a maiden lady, and one day she opened a drawer and showed him her wedding gown. He had never gone to church, but how she had lost her swain, it was impossible to remember. Dick Lennox may never have told me, but the wedding gown I remembered in the new story was woven around it the same evening, and it pleased Father Tom so much that he wished to publish the English text with the Irish. The publication of the English text seemed to me to render useless the publication of the story, and Father Tom failed to persuade me, and only Tyrd O'Donoghue's translation appeared in the New Ireland Review. A beautiful translation. If I can judge it from Rolston's retranslation, full of exquisite little turns of phrase, Cuno Meyer, and who knows better, tells me that the Irish text exhales the folk flavour that I sought for and missed, and Hyde, who will never take sides on any subject, admits that the Irish version gives him more pleasure, for though I often meet good English, it is seldom I come across a good piece of Irish. Almsgiving and The Clerk's Quest were published, subsequently, in the New Ireland Review, and both pleased Father Tom, and it was not till the 4th month that I began to feel the restrictions of the New Ireland Review. I had plenty of subjects in stock, but not one that I thought Father Tom would think suitable. Homesickness might go into the review, but somehow I could not see it included in a schoolbook. The exile still had still less, and the worst of it was that the exile was nearly written. It had taken a fortnight to write, a longish short story, and a downright good subject for narrative, if I may say so without impertinence. And it was for no fault in the writing that Father Tom rejected it. He liked the story, and he liked homesickness even better than the exile. But he made me feel that it could hardly be included in a collection of stories which he could recommend as a textbook for the intermediate. Yes, I answered, I quite see. Stories about things without moral or literary tendencies. Stories like Turgenev's. Of the horse that is stolen and recovered again. So the owner thinks at first, but after a while he begins to think the horse less wonderful than the horse he lost, and the uncertainty preys upon his mind to such an extent that he ends by shooting the horse. That is what we want, a wonderful story, and one excellently well suited to a textbook, for all children love horses, it is one of their first interests. But my mind seemed closed for the time being to the stories suitable to a textbook and wide open to those that would lead me away from Father Tom and the New Ireland Review. And this was a grief to me, for I knew full well that my contributions to the New Ireland Review were the link that bound me to my friend, if he will allow me to call him friend. We shall not meet again, and if we do, of what use? We are like ships. All and sundry have destinies and destinations. There is little Nietzsche in me, but this much of him I remember, that we must pursue our courses valiantly, come what may. Father Tom and I had lain side by side in harbour for a while, but the magnetism of the ocean drew me, and I continued to write, feeling all the while that my stories were drawing me away from Catholic Ireland. Story followed story, each coming into my mind before the story on the blotting pad was finished, and each suggested by something seen or something heard. When I was called to Castlebar to fulfil the office of High Sheriff, Father Lyons showed me the theatre he had built, and it was A.E., I think, who told me that he knew a priest who lived in the great waste lying between Cross Marlena and Belmullet. He once liked reading, but now he spent his evenings knitting. "I can see your priest," I cried, and wrote the playhouse in the waste and a letter to Rome. A little wreath of stories was woven one evening at the Moat House out of the gossip of a maid who was prone to relate the whole countryside. And she did this so well that she seemed to be relating a village odyssey, incident following incident, with bewildering prodigality. To omit any seemed a losing. But in writing, order and sequence are necessary, and all I could make use of were the four little tales entitled Some Parishioners. It is a pity that more time was not spent on the writing of them. But the English language was still abhorrent to me, and my text was looked upon by me as a mere foundation for an Irish one, and the stories might never have been finished, or not finished at the time, for I could trust Tadhg O'Donoghue to fill up the ruts for me. If it had not been for Stella's interest in them, part of our bargain was that I should read them to her in the drawing room, in the Moat House after dinner, and her mind being one of those large, tidy minds that can find no pleasure in broken stories or harsh or incomplete sentences, I got from her the advice I needed to put the finishing hand to the stories before sending them to Tate. "Whose task," she said, "will be much lightened thereby. Badly constructed sentences are difficult to translate." Well, the irony. "Whose task," comma, she said, comma, "will be much lightened thereby," semicolon. "Badly constructed sentences are difficult to translate." That is one sentence. We stood by the bridge, looking into the moat, and hearing water faintly trickling through the summer tangle of flowering weeds, we fetched a pole and measured 4 or 5 feet of mud. Below the mud was a flagged bottom, which went far to prove that Stella was right in her surmise that the moat had once been used as a breeding place for trout. But if trout had been bred in the moat, trout could be bred in it again, and Stella was at last persuaded that the cleansing of the moat would be a pleasant summer's work for the villagers, and that we should take great interest in the laying down of the spawn and in netting the fish when they had grown to 1/2 pound. Trout grew to that size in a piscina, and talking of the pleasure of the netting, she trailing the net on one side of the stream and I on the other, we passed round the house into the rich garden she had planted. "I think you care more for weeds than for flowers," she said, her little hardship being my lack of interest in her garden, for a garden was part of her instinct as much as her painting. And my clearest remembrance of her is a tall figure in the evening, light moving through flower beds. In front of us was a great sweeping cornfield covering several acres, rare in Ireland, where all the country is grass, and on the other side, the valley of Liffey extended mile after mile, blue hills gathering the landscape up into its rest at last. Our eyes sought for Rathfarnham, 4 or 5 miles away, and we spoke of the two rivers, the Liffey and the Dodder, and of the herdsmen that followed the cattle. Ireland was new to us both, almost as new to me as it was to her, and we were interested in the country we had come to live in. She more playfully and more humanely than I, being a painter, whereas the Boer War still continued to vex me, driving me forward relentlessly, and making me a tiresome companion at times. Stella, cordial, unmoral appreciation of Ireland was a great help to me, and her fine ear for idiom drew my attention to the beauty of peasant speech in our walks through the valley of the Liffey. Her eyes measuring the landscape all the while, noting the shapely trees and the lonely farmhouses, she and Florence often spent nights together in the Sussex woods, and now, inspired by the summertime, she began to speak to me of a night out upon the mountain, and one evening we drove to the end of the mountain road and walked half a mile with our rugs and lay down under the ruins of the Hellfire Club. Hard by is the gaunt ruin of an unfinished castle, begun with reckless extravagance by whom names slip away, but the sight of the ruin against the hillside remains distinct. Pause there, I guess, for tonight. Really interesting that the ruin is called the Hellfire Club. That is the name of the Dungeons and Dragons club that the kids belong to in the show Stranger Things. And were they referencing whatever this thing is? I just assumed they thought it was a cool name for a Dungeons and Dragons game, so they called it the Hellfire Club. But what is the Hellfire Club? I just thought it was a Dungeons and Dragons team. Anyway, let's pause there for tonight. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.